Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. You can support Witchlit and the serious book habit it requires at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. And you can be part of the show by sending in your own death, sex, religion, politics, money questions for our guests to victoria@witchlitpod.com. If you like what we're doing here, please subscribe and give us a rating or a view wherever you listen to podcasts. It really does help other witches find the show. Here's to never getting to the bottom of our to-be-read piles. Kathy Lynn is an artist, a blogger, a tarot reader, and a writer of stories filled with magic and mystical beings. She illustrated The Butterfly Payoff by Kelly R. Stone and has published two coloring books, Conscious Coloring and Carnal Coloring. She's been a featured blogger at Women's Lifelink and Three Shared Paths. Now she is making her way into the world of fiction, where she explores the stories of all manner of magical beings and creatures. When she's not madly researching and writing, taking deep dives into tarot, or working in her day job, she's quietly living between her farm in rural southern Tennessee and Nashville with her four furry overlords. Cats, of course. Kathy Lynn, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. And I will do my usual disclaimer that Kathy and I know each other. We have a little bit of a history.
Just a small amount.
Yeah. I always like to tell people, because I feel like the interviews with folks I know, like, they just tend to be different. They're like, oh, they have such a great rapport. It's like, yeah, we've known each other for years. That's why. Right. Yeah. So our first question for everybody on the show is why write?
The simplest answer is because I can't not write. I've written stories since I could form complete sentences. So it's kind of been, I've written for a very, very long time, various things, grade school, you know, dramatic little stories, and you know, everybody in the room read them and that kind of stuff. I used to make up stories on the bus for a couple of boys, my cousin and a friend of his. I'd make up ghost stories for them on the bus so they wouldn't be so bored. We would start the story the next day, you know, that kind of thing. And then I wrote short stories in high school and college, and yeah, and then life kind of hit, and I had an idea for a book, and I started that book. I can't tell you how many times I started that book. And finally, National Novel Writing Month, I discovered that, and I wrote my first book in that 30-day window, 50,000 words, and that was the one I wrote, and it was, you know, it wound up being like 75,000 words or something like that. And it was exciting to finally have one on paper, you know, have one written down. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so yes, because I can't not.
Yeah, and I think that's true for a lot of writers. It's just like one of those things that grabs you early. I mean, not everybody, but a lot of people just get grabbed by writing early. You know, they were readers and then they want to tell their own stories. So I think that's par for the course. You're in good company, I guess, is what I would say. You're in good company.
Yes.
So I'm very excited because you are in a different place in your publishing journey than other folks we've had on the show. So you have some complete stories out there and you are looking to publish. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? Like what that, like going from that transition of I'm going to finish a story to I'm going to look to get this book out in the world, like what that's been like for you?
You know, it's been kind of a strange journey because I'll tell you, and you know, I'm sure that there are other writers out there that are not quite pub that are not published yet. I have 5 first draft novels. You know, in a drawer kind of situation. And going back to look at them and try to figure out how to fix them and how to edit them, it is very daunting for someone who has never done it. And I really wanted to move to do novels. You know, I really wanted it to be a novel, you know, and that kind of thing, and a full-blown book. And and write that kind of thing. But I've struggled with that. It's been a struggle because it's really hard. And the other thing that I'll speak to about that journey too is I'm a single person. So I don't have a spouse who can, you know, be the supporting person while I'm trying to edit books and, you know, do a book and try to figure out how to get it published and all those things. I don't have that support system there because I am a single person and I have been most of my life. So it makes it a little more difficult to move into that phase of looking and trying to figure out how to get published. And then, you know, as things started to turn over the last several, 10, maybe 15 years, the big publishers are really hard to get to. And then there came this wave of self-publishing and how you do that and, you know, trying to figure out how to get into all of that. So I'm just now at a point where I feel like I'm ready to try to publish something. And that has been very exciting because it's the first time in all these years of writing stuff and having these drafts and working on stories and working on learning world building and how to do all of that, that I finally have something in a novella that I'm ready to start trying to figure out how to publish. And I, you know, I'm finally at a place where I feel like I can and where I feel like I have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it does answer the question. And I think you touched on a couple really important things that, you know, writing is not a way that most of us make money, especially not when you start out. And if you aren't writing professionally, like for magazines or newspapers or something, there's not really any way to support yourself with that way. Either hope you have a spouse, hope you're independently wealthy, something. So yeah, I think that's, you know, one of those things that people have to think about is like, it's time intensive. Like it's a time intensive thing. So how do you make that work? And then, there's pitfalls with professional publishing, you know, with traditional publishing. There's pitfalls with independent publishing. You know, how do you navigate that and decide what's best for you? Like, how much control do you want? You know, and, you know, one of the reasons I chose independent publishing was because I was in my mid 40s and I was like, I don't know that I want to wait. I don't know that I want to go through that more protracted, you know, traditional publishing arc. I'd rather just get it out there and see what happens.
And you touched on something else there. You touched on something else there for me as well, because I am 60. I turned 60 this year. And so, you know, suddenly I'm like, oh my gosh, where I thought I had all this time, I don't really have that kind of time anymore. You know, there's more years behind me probably than, well, obviously there's more years behind me than there are going forward. And so I do want to be published. And I have had some short stories published in some small little magazines that aren't even in business anymore. And, you know, I've done a little writing for other things. I was a part of a blog for about 3 years that was read on every continent in the world, which was really cool and really fun. So, I mean, I have done some of that kind of thing, and all of it was either through a small independent magazine or, you know, through a blog space where I'm publishing it myself. And so I found that very rewarding. And so that's one of the reasons that right now I am very much so leaning more toward independent writing or independent publishing or self-publishing, because it just feels more rewarding that way. I mean, I know it would be awesome to get some kind of great publishing deal from, you know, one of the big conglomerate publishers, but I don't know. I kind of like the idea of the grassroots kind of thing. And, you know, yeah, it feels more comfortable for me at this point in my life. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. I'm going to pause for a second because my cat is going insane.
I feel your pain.
The joys of recording with a tiny furry monster in your office.
Yes.
So he got
every
kicked out.
Overlord.
Yes. But no, I do like, yeah, I mean, the control issue and getting it out there. And like, for me, that was a lot of it. And I mean, yeah, like you do get distribution, you get a little higher profile with a traditional publisher, and that, you know, there's no way around that. You also don't have to pay your own editors and your own cover designer and all of those things. So it is, there's an expense to independent publishing that, you know, makes it, again, kind of a privilege to be able to do that too, you know, to have the money to do that.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot of, but there's a lot of pieces.
Yeah. And there's so many writers in the world now. I mean, I've been kind of floored over the last several years at the number of books and writers and newcomers and groups of writers writing under one name and, you know, all of that stuff. It's kind of, it's a little daunting even just to think about publishing. You know, you start looking, especially if you're an avid reader, you start looking at all of that stuff and you look at what you're reading yourself. Mm-hmm. And then you look at what you hear other people are reading. And, you know, suddenly it feels like, well, why would I even want to try to publish something? Why would I even want to step out there and do that? But then I also remember that for voracious readers like I am, there comes a point where I'm struggling to find something that I think is interesting to read. And so the more there is out there to choose from, the higher the likelihood is that I'm going to find another writer that I enjoy reading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody has the exact same take on any story or any trope or any, you know, nobody has the exact same style of writing or voice or any of that stuff. So, you know, when you think about it from that perspective, it's more of a, man, I really should get something out there because there's so many people that are reading now and they're reading the kind of stuff that I want to write. And it, you know, it's time to make a stand.
Yes, I agree. And I have said this before on the show, and I'll say it probably more times, but I just want people to get their stories in the world. Like, I just want, like, I have had the privilege of reading your novella and loved it and can't wait. Like, I am almost envious of people who will get to read it for the first time because I enjoyed it so much. So, I definitely want to push that soapbox out and go, yes, you know, you are the only person who can tell your story, to paraphrase Neil Gaiman. You're the only person who can do that. Right. And yeah, everybody, I do think everybody has a story in them. I don't think everybody wants to tell it in a book or, you know, like, but I do love that, you know, in theory, every person has a story in them. And, you know, it's just being able to get it out on paper. That's where the work comes in. So, or yes, pixels, yes, depending on how you write. So,
yeah. And, you know, I don't, people always talk about the blinking cursor and the white page and how daunting that is. And I don't find that daunting at all. You know, give me a white piece of paper any day of the world and I will write a story. What I find daunting is honing that story and fixing that story and making sure that it has the elements in it that it needs to have and editing it and taking those pieces out that you thought were so good, but they just don't fit in the story. It's a whole other thought process. We were talking about this earlier, a whole other thought process that doesn't actually fit in the story that you're writing because, you know, your reader is going to want to know the outcome of that story and that story is not the one you're telling. You know, and so you have to pull some of those elements back out, but still, you know, keep up with your foreshadowing and your thought process and your story and your arc and that world building that you have to do when you're writing in any kind of a fictional world, whether it's witches and bears and werewolves, oh my, or it's, you know, just a basic murder mystery fiction. You're building a world of some kind, or you're interacting in a world that's already known.
Yeah.
Because if you're, you know, like if your setting is like Nashville, Tennessee, that's a city that a lot of people know and experience in a different way. So yeah, I mean, it's a lot of work to, you know, own something once you've got it written and to, you know, get it to the best possible place you can get it. And I'm sure you know this as well as anybody listening who's an artist or a writer. It's never truly finished. You know, you just have to get to a point where you're willing to say, I'm good with this, because otherwise you're going to pick it to pieces. And I've experienced that. That's why I have 5 first draft novels, because, you know, you pick it to pieces and you just never feel like it's quite finished. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a while to learn that that's okay.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the work.
Yeah. I do embroidery. That is my television hobby. Like if I want to watch TV, I do embroidery. Mm-hmm. And
you do beautiful work too.
Oh, thank you. And I always think of writing, like I always kind of compare them a little bit in my brain, because it's like, you know, the reader will only ever see the front of the embroidery, but I know what the back looks like.
Right.
And you know,
not the phrase.
Yeah, it's like, how many times did I get that tied in a knot and had to restart? You know, and then you have to hide all those strings and all those things. And yeah, and so it's there's a lot to it. And you know, I think, and that's one thing I always tell new writers is like, when you're reading something, you're reading the final finished draft. And so when you're writing, you have to remember that what you're writing is the first draft. It's going to be a mess. It's going to be, you know, I had a really good editor early on. I did a developmental edit on my first book. And she said she always thinks about, you know, the first book, you know, with any other kind of art form, you have your tools, you have your material, and you go to work. But with writing, you have to create your own clay first. And then you can massage it into what you think it's going to be. And making the clay is messy work.
Yes, it is. There's water dripping down your arms and your hands are in a mess. And yeah, that's kind of the way it is with writing. The words are dripping all over the place and they're not working.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's tempting when you're writing to compare that to someone else's final draft.
Yeah.
Or even the book you have in your head. It's like, well, you got to get the words on the page. You can figure out what needs to change and what needs to happen. And I think making friends with a good editor is like the best thing you will ever do for yourself as a writer.
So. Oh, okay. Yeah. I've been considering that for one of the novels that I have as first draft to kind of figure that process out, because, you know, you don't just automatically know how to edit, and certainly not your own work, because it's precious. It's your baby. You know, it's, you don't want to call it ugly, even where it is. And, you know, it's going to have some beautiful, beautiful parts in it, but there's also going to be those ugly edges that need to be fixed.
Yeah. And I always feel like I'm too close to it to know, like, I know what's in my head, but that might not have made it to the paper. That may not have made it to the page. So
yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the things that those initial readers before you actually publish it, those trusted people that you kind of let read your ugly baby, you know, to see what they think. I think that's one of the benefits of that. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine's husband actually read the novella that I'm working to get published, and he gave some really good feedback as a male reader. And it was amazing, you know, the feedback that he gave. And he's not somebody who, you know, typically is a beta reader and is used to giving that kind of feedback. So it was very interesting to get that perspective and to hear where some things needed to be fixed. And it helped me tremendously in getting the story to where it's at now. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of value in that type of feedback as well. But I like your comment about a developmental editor, because I think that's something that I definitely need in some of the novels that I do want to pull out and dust off.
I found it incredibly helpful.
Yeah. And I think they're worth it.
And I mean, for people who don't know or people who are interested, I mean, you can pay anywhere from like $250 to a couple thousand dollars for a developmental editor. It just depends on where they are in their career and who they worked with and what their prices are and where they live a little bit too.
Right.
So, you know, there's some ranges there, but and you know, how much you want to work. Do you just want them to read it through and give you a corrected text or notes back, or do you want to have a session with them? Or, but I do think it's worth it. But since we are a witch lit podcast, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that aspect of it and like how, like the supernatural, the occult, witchcraft, magic, whatever that, how that plays into your work. Cause I know that's what you read and I know that's what you write. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about like how you weave that into your work.
Yeah, it's definitely a thread that moves through pretty much everything I write. You know, and part of that is because of my own great interest in it. And, yeah, so like in the novella, the world building that I had to do there, because there's so much that is imbued with that supernatural. There's so many, not just the characters, but the setting in which the story takes place is also imbued with a certain level of consciousness and a certain level of supernatural ability and thought process. And it's something that I feel really strongly about too. And it's fascinating to work with and to weave into a story. Especially if you're dealing with any kind of a witch in the story, which my current novella doesn't have a witch per se in the story, but there is mention of a witch and witches in the story. And there's a mention of spells and spell casting. And the main character has an ability to cast spells and do those types of things. And so there's that whole working it into the story, but also making it ring true and feel true, mm-hmm. and feel like it's a possibility, versus, you know, it's just kind of thrown in there because that's the genre you're writing in. So I love it.
Yeah. How did you decide like what level of magic for the story? Like, what was your, because I think there's, you know, there's like folks who write like what a real magic, and it's kind of like how we are in the world as witches, that is like magic, mm-hmm. is this thing that we do, but it doesn't have CGI effects. And then there's like, you know, full explosion magic that comes in. And I think there's some pockets in between. And so I'm just curious, like how you decided, like as you're building this world, because almost I would say there's like an animist element because of that consciousness in the story. Yes, like, how do you decide like what level of magic the story is going to take for you?
Well, to a certain extent, it depends on the characters, and it depends on what I need those characters to be able to do. Like in this novella, the main character is, you know, he comes from a very long line of his particular brand of magic and secret keeping. And so he has to be imbued with an awful lot of strength and power and fortitude. He has to embody that, and he has to show that as a character, mm-hmm. where some of the others that he comes in contact with are not at the same level that he is and may not even have any kind of real magic at all, but have to live within the confines of the magic that he has and the responsibility that he has to, mm-hmm. that magic and that situation. So for this particular novella, I mean, he really had to be very powerful. And so, you know, I have to weave that in a way that feels true,
right?
And feels natural for him as a character. You know, he's not stumbling over anything. He's not having to refer to anything. He's not having to, you know, think about it before he does it. He knows his confines. He knows his abilities. He knows what he's working with and within, and he is able to just embody that, mm-hmm. and do what he needs to do. Now, in one of the other stories that I have where there is a witch, she is a very old crone, and she's kind of the same way. But there are people around her who have some power that are just coming into it, and they don't understand it, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're terrified of it because they're making weird things happen and blow up without even trying because their emotions are all out of whack. So it really kind of does depend on the character and what the character needs at the time and how they need to feel about it and how they need to work with it and how they need to move through that level of where they are in order to get to a different place or get through what their journey is at that time or where they're trying to achieve, so that there's growth there. There's some sort of an arc there. So I think for me, especially in the witchy type stuff and the spell casting and the, you know, all of those things, it really does kind of depend on the character and where the character is and what they're trying to do as to the level that they might have or the level that I need to weave through it.
Yeah. And I think when you're writing magic, I got advice from our mutual friend AJ early on is that you can't have magic always be the deus machina. Like that can't be the way to always get out of the story. So because it's tempting, yeah. If you're writing a world where there's magic, well, then magic will fix everything. So you kind of have to also play that balance of like, what does magic cost in this world? Right. You know, what is the electric fence they can't touch magically to keep things in line? So you've got conflict.
Yeah. Well, and there's certainly that in the novella because the main character has to do something that is, for most people, would not be anything that they could ever do. Mm-hmm. You know, he has to make a decision and he has to use his magic in a way that is devastating for him. Mm-hmm. And so there's that conflict of his, what he wants and needs in his life versus the responsibility that he carries and what he has to do in order to maintain that responsibility, because it's not something that he can walk away from or turn away from or endanger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dear listeners, it is the gut punch of the novella, let me tell you.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah, but it's beautifully done. Yeah, I'm just excited for this book to get out in the world. So tiny advertisement for pre-book. But yeah, I do think that's one of the things I love about writing magic is that you do really have to think about what it means to be able to really do that kind of big magic that maybe we can't really do in real life, but would like to be able to.
Right.
So.
Well, and to keep it real enough that it feels possible to a certain extent. I mean, I think, you know, there certainly is that level of supernatural in most of the things that I write and in this particular vein of writing that are, you know, everybody knows it's not possible. But there's also that little strand through there usually that you think, oh, could that be possible? Is that possible? Is that something that would manifest in the real world? And if it would, how would it? And to try and kind of show that in some form or fashion, I think is kind of fascinating too.
Yeah. And I do love the idea, like, you know, if multiple universes are real, could this be real somewhere?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like, did I create an extra universe? Yeah. No, I do love that. So for you, like, you know, kind of on this writing journey, do you feel like there's like especially good advice or maybe especially bad advice that anybody's given you that's kind of been the thing that sticks with you?
There are a couple of major adages. One of them is the write what you know. Well, okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't learn about something to the point that you can write about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do think that you pull to a certain extent from your own experiences in the world, no matter what vein of writing you're in, whether it's, you know, fiction or nonfiction or supernatural or whatever it is, you're always pulling from the things that you quote unquote know. But there's also a world of information out there that you can pull in from your research and those types of things. So I think it's a little limiting sometimes when we say, write what you know. I think that's a little bit limiting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, especially it being my age, I've read a lot of books on writing. I've, you know, watched a lot of videos on writing, and people are always saying, you know, you have to outline, you have to outline, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do the other thing. We don't have to do any of that. You know, you write from the vein that you're able to write from. And there are people who say, you have to write every day. Well, no, you don't. You can still get an incredibly good story out by writing every weekend or writing when you have a schedule where you can write. And again, that kind of goes back to my being single for most of my life. I don't have the luxury of being able to sit down and write every night because I have responsibilities. I have to do, nobody's just going to do them.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's going to clean the house for me. Nobody's going to wash those dishes over there or take care of that litter box to that cat or, you know, sit and love on the cat because she's 17 years old and she wants to sit in your lap for a while. I mean, and those are kind of facetious things, but at the same time, there's responsibilities that we have as adults that we have to do. And by the time I go to work and work all day and look at a computer screen all day long because I work from home, sometimes the last thing I want to do is look at a computer screen for another hour or 2 hours to write. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's limiting to say to someone, especially a new writer, that they have to do certain things like that, like write every day. I don't think that's realistic.
Yeah.
And that's my opinion. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people out there going, oh my God, I can't believe she said, you know, or whatever. But that's kind of my opinion and my thought process. And you know, yeah, I mean, it could be why I'm 60 and trying to get my first novella published. But when you have responsibilities, you have responsibilities.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, everybody's process is their own process. And I've said this and listeners have probably heard it before, but like, there are people who are going to be really disciplined who can write every day. And that's part of their process is that I'm going to write every day, no matter what. And that's what keeps me writing. And there are people whose you know, life gets in the way. Like you just have to write when you can. So I think it's, you know, there's so much good advice out there. And then there's so much good advice out there that just doesn't apply. Like sometimes you just have to figure out what applies to you and figure out what works. And that can be a challenge. I mean, to figure out what works for you, you may have to try lots of different things. There's this, I think, apocryphal anecdote about Nabokov standing on a chair and writing on top of the refrigerator. But I think about that a lot. It's like, if that's what gets the book out, then that's what you do, you know?
Right.
That's what you need to do. Like, I really hope he didn't have to write that way. But, you know, if he did, then great that he figured it out for himself, because that would not be something that would have come to my mind to do.
Exactly. And I think and I'm no one to give anybody advice, but if I was going to give advice to somebody, I think it would be figure out what works for you. Mm-hmm. And if it works for you to write every day, write every day. If it works for you to block out 4 hours on Saturday to write, then block out 4 hours on Saturday to write.
Yeah. And if it means sometimes you got 2 days worth of dirty dishes, then that's okay. You know, like
that's okay.
But they'll still there when you're done writing.
Yeah, they will. They absolutely will. And I am certainly not one that doesn't leave a sink full of dishes from time to time.
Yeah, I was going to say my sink has dishes in it right now, too. So but, I'm podcasting rather than doing dishes.
Right. There you go. But I do think it is, like you said, about figuring out what works for you and then working on it from that standpoint. And I have found in my own writing that it sometimes helps to walk away from it for a week. Mm-hmm. And let it gestate, because gestation is part of the writing process. Pondering is part of the writing process. Thinking about a character is part of the writing process. You know, even having props is sometimes part of the writing process. You know, the title of the next story that's going to come, and this is a prop that I had bought, just a little cheap prop. And it's a black top hat. I'm showing Victoria the prop. Mm-hmm. It's a black top hat that cost me like $12 off Amazon. Mm-hmm. But it features prominently in the next novella. And I find that sometimes is a way to stay on track. But it's also part of that mm-hmm. pondering process. It's a part of that creative process for me to look at something and go, yeah, okay. And then do research on that thing and think about it and ponder it. And that's all part of the process, too. It's not all just sitting down at a laptop or a typewriter if that's your if that's your thing, and writing.
Yeah. Well, and I think about what you talked about earlier about writing what you know versus all the information out there. And I can't remember where I heard it, and I probably should have written it down and quoted them directly. It's write what you're willing to learn a lot about, you know?
Yes.
And yes. I think that to me has been one of the joys of writing, is being able to say, okay, I have this interest in this. I've been cooking on this idea for like 6 years. I'm going to dive in and I'm going to try it and do the research and interview people and figure out how to make it work. And then that's exciting. And then when someone goes, oh, do you do blah, blah, blah? And it's like, no, I just read about it in a different book. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's, you know, I had to do a ton of research about top hats. I didn't know much about them, except that they're, you know, they were a man's fashion accessory that was really, really big in the 1800s. Well, I mean, there's a whole story around that. Apparently, there's a legend and somewhat story, or it was an article in a magazine or a paper or something, that the first top hat that was, quote, the quote unquote first top hat that was worn created such a stir that women were fainting in the street, and the man who wore it wound up being arrested for inciting, you know, all of this melee on the street. I was like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me, right? But no,
it
was in almost every piece of research somewhere in that research.
The top hat caused such a stir.
Yes, it caused such a stir. And, you know, the size of the top hat, was it a stove, you know, top hat that had the, like the Abraham Lincoln top hat, or was it the, what we all kind of have the image of the theater top hat, you know, that men would wear to the theater. And then because of not being able to see over that top hat, they created the springform top hat that would collapse. And I mean, it's fascinating, the things that you learn. It's crazy. I actually saw a picture of one that had a little holder in the very top of the crown for a little derringer.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. And now we all associate it with like magicians and rabbits and stuff too. Which
it has such a, it has such an interesting history and usage. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree. It's such a fun learning process. And that, and you know, like I said before, I think that's a part of, that's also a part and parcel of the writing process.
Yeah. I know.
It shouldn't be discounted as, you know, I'm not working on my book because I'm not writing.
Yeah. Research and, like you said, percolating and, you know, all that is part of it too. And I love that you're basically going down the rabbit hole of the cultural material history of top hats to write this next book about magic. I love that. That's fantastic. But before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I want to give you an opportunity. Okay. You do have some things published that people might be interested in that I want you to talk about, and just kind of, you know, where people can find you or however you want to plug yourself here at the end.
Okay. I actually do have two coloring books out. One of them is called Conscious Coloring, and the thought process behind it was to consciously create and possibly even use it as a way to visualize and manifest things, so that you're concentrating on what you want to manifest while you're coloring, which gives it color hues and a vision. And then you remember when you look at that particular thing that that's what you were envisioning and that you were trying to manifest that thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a conscious coloring is the name of it. And then I also have another one that is carnal coloring. And the idea behind it was to create images that were beautiful, but also very, very sexual in nature. Mm-hmm. And they all are very sexual in nature, and there are words hidden in the images. And the thing about both of the coloring books are they are hand-drawn. They are not computer-generated in any way, shape, form, or fashion. They are all hand-drawn, so there are anomalies. They're not perfect, you know, like the computer images that you see in most of those Zentangle-type coloring books. Mm-hmm. And they're both available on Amazon. And then I also am on Instagram, and Instagram is Kathy Lynn Author. So it's Kathylynnauthor. on Instagram. And that's primarily where you'll find me right now. I do have an author page on Facebook, but I'm not exactly using it so much right now. Once I'm able to figure out where I'm going to land in terms of publishing this novel, I'll be using that as well. But there's not going to be a lot there right now. Yeah. But yeah. So Instagram is primarily the place to find me. And then I also have Kathy Lynn Tarot on Instagram as well, because I have been a reader and teacher of tarot, and I love tarot.
And that's how Kathy and I met.
Yes, it is.
I took a tarot class from her and it was brilliant. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I learned a lot. So excellent.
So those are the main ways to find me at this point.
Yeah. And I'll put that in the show notes so people can find your coloring books and where to catch you on Instagram. So we're going to do our game of chance question at the end, I joke is my Scorpio nature question. I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, and money, some of which we may have already covered. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you'd like. So I'm going to roll and see what we get. Five, money. Oh, this has come up twice in a row with interviews. I like it.
Okay.
So let's say that lightning strikes with your novella series and it is a runaway bestseller. Movie rights are sold, and then they actually make the movie, because a lot of people sell rights and they never make a movie out of it.
Right. Wow.
And so you have amassed a small fortune. So what is the first responsible decision you make about what to do with this money? And what is the first splurge thing you do with this money?
Okay. You know, I play the what if I won the lottery game a lot.
It is kind of like that. I mean, honestly, for something like this to happen, it's about the odds, I think. But
yeah. So the first responsible thing I would do is determine how much of that money I would be investing for the future, and in what ways would I invest it. And then the most irresponsible thing that I would do is travel. And probably buy the house of my dreams, which could also be considered, you know, the smart thing to do. But at the same time, it's also a very frivolous thing to do as well when you already have a house. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly fine and there's nothing wrong with it. But yeah, those would probably be the first things I would do. Because, you know, it's funny. Time changes your perspective. You know, there was a time when I would have said, oh my God, I'd go buy a Lamborghini, and that would be the irresponsible thing. In my world today, I look at a Lamborghini and go, oh my God, that's going to ride like a log truck. I don't want that. It's beautiful, but my gosh, I need a much more comfy ride. So it changes. Your perspective changes a little bit over time. So yeah, not glamorous, but that would be my answer to that kind of question.
I don't know. I mean, to me, travel is like, it's one of the things that feeds the well for me. And it's been a hard part of the pandemic years is not traveling as much, because it just is like that to me is like the ultimate, it doesn't even feel like a luxury. I mean, it is a luxury and a privilege to get to travel. Even if you're budget traveling, it's still a privilege. But like, to me, it just feels like breath and air, because I love it so much, and it just has, you know, been a huge part of my life. So yeah, I think I would not call travel irresponsible.
Well, and I'm kind of like, you know, travel really does kind of feed the well for me in a lot of ways. It's seeing, especially when you travel to European countries, those places that have been around forever, like when you walk on a cobblestone street in Rome that Alexander the Great rode around on in, you know, 1 AD kind of thing. It really puts a lot of things into perspective for me. And it just teaches me a lot about where we are today and where we were then. I know that sounds so cliche, but it really is perspective gaining, and it really does give me ideas, especially when you're writing in a supernatural kind of vein. Those beings sometimes have been around for a very, very long time, or in some cases, if you're incorporating gods and goddesses into your work, forever, you know, from the beginning. And so having a perspective on what forever looks like, or what a long time of growth would look like to, say, a vampire that was created in, you know, 500 BC. Seeing those streets in Rome, feeling those cobblestones under your feet, touching those things, gives you perspective for that character in the long run. So I guess travel really isn't,
it's a joy. Yeah. And it's funny you're talking about perspective. And as I get older, like I have mostly traveled in North America and Europe. And as I get older, like I really want the challenge of traveling places that don't feel as easy to travel as an American. Mm-hmm. Like I'd really like to go to Asia. Right. I'd really like to go to Africa, you know, different countries in Africa. And, you know, I'm hoping I get to do that. Like, I'm hoping I get to stick around long enough to do some of those big trips. So,
well, fingers crossed for you. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So here's to travel and, you know, books making millions. If that can happen still, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Yes. Right. Awesome. I'm not sure that happens anymore, but maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. Like, at least, you know, I always joke about winning the lottery, but we don't buy tickets. At least I am buying a ticket by writing a book, I guess. Maybe.
Yes. That is one way to look at it. You are putting it out into the universe that you are open to that kind of income.
That's right. Well, awesome. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you for sharing your journey. And I hope that listeners get kind of a different perspective on things from this episode.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been fun to just kind of talk about writing and how things play into that, and you know, the journey in itself. It's absolutely worth it, even if you never publish something. It's the feeling of accomplishment that I have when I finally type the end is amazing, and it's something that nobody can give you.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that you've done for yourself, whether you ever published that thing or not. There is just something about having put a story on paper, or, you know, in a Word document or whatever you want to call it, that nobody can take away from you. And it's pretty amazing.
Yep, I agree. Oh, thank you so much.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Thanks for listening and for reading witchy.